This is Audible.
Random House Audio presents Who's Looking Out for You? This is the author, Bill O'Reilly. Introduction. It ain't me. It ain't me. I ain't no millionaire's son. John Fogerty, fortunate son. Let's immediately tee off a few sensitive souls out there by beginning with some racial profiling. Here goes. If you have started this book, the chances are you're an independent type, but your skin color and ethnicity are not predictable. I don't actually know you, but I know a lot about you. That's because there's a certain profile that O'Reilly watchers, listeners, and readers fit most of the time. Sure, there are drive-by viewers who watch The O'Reilly Factor as they would a gruesome accident, fascinated but repelled at the same time. And there are snobs who tune in just to shake their heads over the boorishness of it all. But the everyday American who understands what the Factor concept is all about is generally a person who wants to live life honestly and make his or her own way. That person is often responsible, generous, aware that others around them also have lives to live, and unabashedly patriotic. You, very likely, are one of those people. In the beginning of the program, the fall of 1996, the elite media tried to marginalize the Factor concept by assigning it a conservative label. That's how they tagged us, hoping that label would frighten away those not on the right. But as millions of Americans of all political persuasions watched on television and read my first two books, The O'Reilly Factor and The No Spin Zone, the establishment press fled, dazed and confused. How could a cable TV news show have such a robust impact when network TV news was losing audience every quarter? The so-called elite scribes couldn't figure it out, and they still can't. The warfare between the folks who liked The Factor and the eggheads in the press who looked down upon it became quite intense at times, but finally the numbers got too big. Millions of Americans tuned in daily to watch and also listen on the radio, causing many in the media to finally wave the white flag. The American people had made The O'Reilly Factor into a powerful entity, and the momentum the folks provided resulted in The Factor, the TV program, being nominated by the American Television Critics Association for Best News and Information Program in 2002. In 2003, your humble correspondent, me, was chosen by the industry magazine Television Week as the second most powerful person in TV news. Yikes! The NBC News chief, Neil Shapiro, was first. So now it's time for me to try to give you something more concrete than a big thank you. This book is an attempt to zero in on one of the most important parts of life, the ability to recognize who really cares about you as a person and who does not. If you can master the art of determining that, your life will be much happier and probably much longer. If you fail to understand who's looking out for you, get a good lawyer right now. You're going to need one. Trust fund babies and corporate weasels are not allowed to read this book. If you try, I'll find out and come to your house, thereby ruining your phony reputation. I will seize your copy of the book and mock you for disobeying the rules. Why would a child of privilege need to waste time with my words? You don't need anyone looking out for you because you have resources and power already. This book is for everyday Americans who are fighting the good fight. If you are in this category, here's my first piece of advice. You must learn to become a problem solver, not a problem creator. Problems are one of the few things in life that you can count on. Enough problems will find you so that you don't need to drag unnecessary ones into the house. If you're going to drink a quart of bourbon a day or smoke crack, this book is not going to help you. In fact, if you are in the above category, you've probably stolen this book. Give it back now. Problems are the reason human beings are at the top of the food chain. We are the only ones with the brain power to solve dilemmas. If our ancestors hadn't developed problem-solving skills, they would have vanished like the dinosaurs. In the beginning, before cable, our ancestors, the primates, lived a marginal existence until a giant animal ate them. That was it. Then we evolved and learned to stick a fiery torch in the giant animal's face. Problem-solving separates the successful humans from the ones in the penitentiary. This book is going to help you learn how to solve the inevitable problems that visit every single person on this earth. And don't believe those self-help books that tell you some problems will go away forever. That's a lie. Problems will hunt you down, slap you around, and leave you disillusioned and sometimes broke. That is, unless you meet them at the door and knee them in the groin. Most problems can be neutralized with smarts and sometimes help from others. Your biggest advantage will be knowing just who's looking out for you and who is getting a kick out of seeing you suffer. Develop that knowledge, and you're on your way to being a kick-butt problem solver. But even armed with the knowledge that this book will give you, the struggle to succeed will be intense because you are running uphill against those who have more of everything. But we have the numbers. According to Michael Zweig, a professor of economics at the State University of New York at Stony Brook, 62% of the labor force in the USA are working-class people. There are many definitions of the working class, but Zweig has come up with a good one. People who do not have much control or authority over the pace or the content of the work and are not the supervisor or the boss. That means you can be a high-priced lawyer billing hours or a sanitation worker cleaning up. If you are not calling your own shots, you are working class, and you need every edge you can get. This book will get you that edge in both the workplace and at home. We'll analyze a personal part of your existence, your family, friends, teachers, pastor, and so on. These people often have incredible access to your life. They can really help or really hurt you, sometimes without you even knowing it. And unfortunately, there is no rule that says you're entitled to great parents and relatives or a solid support system. Some lucky Americans get terrific love and guidance from the beginning. Most don't. Instead, many of us have to put up with all kinds of destructive nonsense at home, and much of the time we don't even know what's going on until the damage is done. But when you finish this book, that will change. You will know what's going on. Who's looking out for you will also deal with external forces that are unleashed against us: the government, the media, the legal system, and others. These powerful entities can crush you unless you understand them and take measures to protect yourself and your family. Finally, throughout the book, I have frankly named the names that need to be named, much as I do on TV and on the radio, and also in print. Please understand that the examples I provide are based solely on my own instincts. Sometimes I'm wrong, and sometimes I even admit it. But often I'm right because I observe closely and consult widely. Before I blister somebody, I analyze a person carefully because I don't want to abuse my power. But ultimately, judgments are made in the no-spin zone. Take this example. I think Bernard Cardinal Law of Boston is a villain. I think he allowed children to be hurt to protect his own reputation in Rome. Based on the evidence I've seen, Law allowed perverted priests to go unsupervised because he couldn't be bothered with such an inconvenient and potentially embarrassing problem. His main concern, again in my judgment, was holding on to power and avoiding any kind of public scandal that might have tarnished his image with the Pope. The way I see it, Law put his own career above the welfare of little kids. The shepherd of the flock was looking out only for himself. But I could be wrong. Please keep that in mind. I'll state my case and back it up as best I can. I'll lay it all out for you, but in the end, it's you who must make the final judgment. Only you can determine who is trustworthy and who is not in your life. But you need information and guidelines in order to do that. You need a no-spin roadmap, pardon a cliche. And here it comes. However, there is one more point to make before the journey begins. Self-delusions can negate even the best advice and most accurate observations. In order to be truly successful, you have to be brutally honest with yourself. Excuses and rationalizations have to be put aside. You must define your own life and not let others do it for you. You must evaluate people and situations the way they are, not the way you want them to be. And you must evaluate yourself honestly and absorb the pain that will inevitably cause. So onward. Let's find out just who is looking out for you. Chapter 1, Folk Music. Papa don't preach. I'm in trouble deep, but I've made up my mind. I'm keeping my baby. Madonna, Papa don't preach. It is brutally unfair to the children involved, but there are almost 12 million one-parent families in the USA. Single mothers run the majority of those families, and most of those mothers are poor. According to the U.S. Census, about 70% of all African American babies are born out of wedlock, as opposed to 27% for whites. So do the math and face the result. Millions of American kids are getting hosed from day one. And there's little any of us can do about it. We live in a free society. If irresponsible people have kids, there is nothing any American authority can do to stop it. In China, they kill babies. In some Islamic countries, they kill a woman who gets pregnant without a husband, or even has sex outside of marriage. These policies, of course, are barbaric and constitute major human rights violations because, believe it or not, women and babies are human beings too. Here in the good old USA, our Constitution gives careless, foolish citizens all the leeway in the world to bring children into the world and then not care for them. Millions of fathers abandon their kids, and it's rare that any of them sees a day in jail. We all know people who are absolutely awful to their children, just as we all know heroic parents, single and otherwise, who raise successful, happy children despite the heavy odds. There is no question that our society has now embraced the casual approach when it comes to having children. Columnist Kathleen Parker nailed it. Today, having a baby, she said, is like swinging through McDonald's for a burger. One baby all the way, hold the dad. And the damage is incalculable. Over the next 2 years, about 40% of American babies will be born out of wedlock. 1 million teenagers are likely to have a child this year alone, and only 3 in 10 will be married. Half of all the mothers who have kids in their teens will be poor the rest of their lives. The government spits out these stats like baseball players spit out sunflower seeds. The politicians use these poor children as pawns in the never-ending game of government entitlements. Society recognizes the problem but can't solve it. Almost all of our social ills can be traced back to chaotic homes. Luckily, most of us are born into a home with two parents, and thanks to Norman Rockwell and Walt Disney, there is an ideal embedded in many of our minds. Two loving parents, clean clothes, nice toys, a picket fence around the yard, and a dog named Barney. Does that sound like your household? My home was a mixture of tradition and chaos. My father wasn't Ozzie Nelson, the TV ideal dad in the 50s and 60s, but he wasn't Ozzy Osbourne either. I wrote about my late father in The O'Reilly Factor, the book, and I think it's safe to say that I had a rough-hewn upbringing. Simply put, there was plenty of tension in my house, along with a lot of yelling and martial arts. My father was Kung, and I was Fu. The perceptive writer James Ellroy, writing in GQ magazine, had an interesting take on my upbringing. O'Reilly's old man died of melanoma, Ellroy wrote. He was a rough-edged guy. Fear ran him. He peaked in World War II. He was a naval officer. He did important work in the Jap occupation. He settled in Levittown, New York. He raised his son and daughter strict. He worked as an accountant. He hated said work. He stuck with it. Fear made him stick. He lived through the Depression. He fed off pics of hobo shantytowns and bean lines. He stayed Spartan middle class. He was class bound by fear. He bought the implicit American line, stick where you are and wish your kids more. O'Reilly Pear held his mud. O'Reilly Pear cracked a bit on his deathbed. He told his son that he never fulfilled his promise. Bill O'Reilly vowed to do it for him. The old man gave him some tools. His strict legacy served more than hindered. The old man was a moral exemplar. His preachings were sound. He erred only in his rigid enforcement. The old man ruled by fear. O'Reilly hated it as a kid. O'Reilly gained respect for it years on. The old man emerged as a teacher. He taught by positive and negative example. He was responsible for his own failures. He was complicit in sustaining the American class system. Ellroy understood my dad's basic resume, but left one important item out. Despite his ordinary life, he was an extremely perceptive man. My father was Abe Lincoln, honest and also knew instinctively who could be trusted and who was auditioning for the role of Judas. But this knowledge did him little good because he was afraid to act on it. The upside of my house was this. There were standards. There was no binge drinking, no drugs, no cursing, no weird displays of inexplicable behavior, except by me. My folks were like their folks before them, reactors. If I acted like a jerk, the reaction was Allen Iverson quick. My parents did not spare the rod. They brooked no disrespect, and they also had no concerns at all about my self-esteem. There were times when I hated my father, I admit it. He knew it. The punishment that descended upon me was mostly uncalled for and born of the frustration of his life. But even in my teens, I realized that my parents wanted me to do well and succeed. As dim as I was, I knew there was love in the house. So now, when I see children at risk, it makes me furious. Take 4-year-old Rilia Wilson, for example. I told her story on The Factor, and it's heartbreaking. She was born in East Cleveland, Ohio. Her father split soon after her birth. Her mother was a drug addict and lost parental rights. So little Rilia went to live with her godmother, Geraldine Graham, in South Florida, a situation that was paid for and supposedly supervised by the state of Florida. Trouble is, the caseworker assigned to Rilia, Deborah Muskelly, didn't make the state-ordered mandatory visits, although in the state files, she falsely recorded that she had. When Rilia turned up missing from her home in early 2001, nobody seemed to care. It took the state 16 months for Florida even to find out about it. Now, you would think the authorities would be all over this case once the facts came to light. A defenseless 4-year-old missing and possibly murdered. You would think everyone in power would rally to see justice done. On television, I asked Florida Governor Jeb Bush to get directly involved in the case. He would not. I asked for the resignation of the head of the Children's Services Department. She stayed on for almost a year until the pressure finally forced Bush to sack her. I asked for the caseworker, Muskelly, to be immediately arrested. She was not, and neither Bush nor anyone else offered an explanation. To say the situation was disgraceful is insult light. Finally, just before the election of 2002, Governor Bush had to act because he was slipping big in the polls. Both the caseworker and the godmother were finally charged. But the hard truth is that nobody in the world cared for little Rilia Wilson. Nobody looked out for her, even though a number of adults were being paid to do that. And so she's still missing and most likely dead. Next time you have parental issues, think about Rilia. Poverty is an enormous problem for children, obviously, but even having money doesn't solve the parental dilemma. Let's take a look at Julio and Enrique Iglesias, the father and son singers. These guys are fabulously wealthy, so it's hard to believe that with all their talent and fame, a smooth relationship didn't evolve. But according to Parade magazine, the two are now rivals in the world of pop music. Enrique Iglesias is quoted as saying this about his famous father. "It's not a normal relationship. After I sold millions of records, he, Julio, would say, 'But you'll never win a Grammy.'" Nice. Julio Iglesias has been blessed with enormous material success, but apparently is competing with his own son for outside adulation. Does that make any sense? Of course not. As everybody knows, money and privilege can screw a kid up fast. Enrique Iglesias was a product of a very messy divorce. As a young child, he lived with his mother in Spain, but her journalism career caused him to be left often in the care of a nanny. When Enrique turned 7, he was sent to live with his father in Miami. But according to friends, the child had to learn music outside his own house because he was afraid Julio would put him down. Enrique has become a music superstar, but his road was tougher than some might think. In a perfect world, every parent would love, nurture, and protect his or her children. If anyone should be looking out for you, it's your mother and father. But as we know, there are no parental guarantees in this life. You can ask Enrique Iglesias, or if you get to heaven, you can ask Rilia Wilson. Many of us are deeply conflicted about our parents. My father and mother certainly provided for me and made damn sure I got educated and was taught the essentials of life. But can I say that my father was always looking out for me? No, I can't. My mother's instincts were much more in that direction, but my father had demons that intruded on his parental duties. As with millions of other American parents, my father set a terrible example by inflicting unnecessary pain on his children. He didn't do this on purpose. He simply couldn't control himself. And therein lies the big parental dilemma. Just like everybody else, a parent might have to do battle with a powerful inner demon, that part of the mental makeup that is self-destructive and evil. If those demons win the battle, the child as well as a parent takes the hit. Abandonment, abuse, addiction, and apathy can scar a child for life, and there's little the kid can do about it. Ask psychiatrists and they'll tell you that children who are mentally or physically abused often grow up to be abusers themselves. In the ongoing scandal in the Roman Catholic priesthood, for example, it's clear that many of the abusers were themselves abused when they were young. That's not an excuse, but it may be a partial explanation. And once understood, the cycle of emotional or physical abuse that spins down from one generation to the next has a better chance of being stopped. It takes awareness, it takes courage, it takes discipline. Most of us have unresolved problems with our parents. Some of these problems are trivial, some much more intense. For your own welfare, it's important that you get to the root of the parental issue and ask this question. Did your parents really look out for you? Did they want you to have a happy and successful life? The question is a bear, frightening and unpredictable. It can be painful even thinking about it. But here are a few guidelines to clear the air a little. Call them the Ten Commandments of Effective Parenting. 1. A parent who is looking out for you will make time for you, if he or she possibly can. Hint, serial golfing is no excuse. 2. All punishments will fit the crime. Discipline is essential, but no parent should inflict frequent physical or mental pain on a kid. Childhood is supposed to be a wondrous, joyful period. Parents are the grown-ups and have to be patient within reason. Words can deeply wound a child. Parents must display kindness and understanding. Corporal punishment should be a last resort and used within guidelines that have been clearly established before any physical punishment is administered. 3. Parents who are looking out for their children will be under control in the house. There will be no random violence, intoxication, sexual displays, uncontrolled anger, or vile language. Sorry, Ozzy. The house should be a refuge, a place where the child feels protected and loved. If it is a chaotic mess, the parents are not looking out for the kids. 4. If a parent is looking out for the child, he or she will educate that child in the best possible way. That includes paying college tuition, if at all possible. Parents owe it to their kids to give them the tools to compete, and those tools are often expensive. But they come before the vacation, the Harley, the leaf blower. If you don't want to sacrifice for your children, don't have them. 5. Parents should be available at all times for emergency talks. All access, as the rock stars say. No excuses here. Ditch the meeting, get back from the mall, get off the phone. There is nothing more important than dealing with a child's crisis immediately, even if it seems trivial to you, the parent. 6. If a parent is looking out for the child, then the child's friends will be screened. The kid's whereabouts will be known at all times, and scholastic progress will be monitored daily. Homework will be looked at, and questions about school will be asked. That's how trouble is spotted before it gets out of hand. That's how you bring out the best in your child. He or she knows you have a strong interest in their lives. They may bitch, but kids badly want that kind of attention. All the research shows that close parental monitoring is the leading factor in whether or not adolescents will engage in high-risk behavior. 7. Rules will be enforced but explained. Parents who truly look out for their kids understand that there are rules in society and that high standards of behavior are the key to a successful life. Rules are good, but rules must have a logical objective. Because I say so can be effective when the kid gets stubborn, but before that conversation stopper is trotted out, try connecting some dots with your kid. It doesn't always work, but the effort is worth it. 8. Parents will be honest at all times. Lead by example. No lying, no cheating, no nasty gossip, no cruelty, no manipulating, no jealousy toward your kids, no competing with them, no overindulging their various whims, and no overprotecting. Parents who are looking out for their kids will prepare them for the rigors of this world. They will educate them after school, encourage generosity and spirituality, and generally do the right thing all the time, or at least in front of the children. 9. Parents will be respectful of their parents. Grandparent abuse or neglect is among the worst possible things a kid can see. This is a very important commandment. You can't effectively look out for your kids if you don't look out for your folks, even if your folks don't deserve it. 10. Finally, effective parents will remove the TVs and computers from the kids' rooms. All media absorption should be done in public space. This is a dangerous world, and the danger is now in your house. If a parent is really looking out for the kid, subversive material must be kept to an absolute minimum. Corrupting influences on children are everywhere, and parents must be full-time firefighters. Life is tough and getting tougher. The demons, the exploiters, want your kids. You must look out for them. Fight hard. So, did your parents obey all those commandments? Chances are they didn't. They're human, after all, even though few kids take that into consideration. The key question, once you reach adulthood, is did your folks try to do the right thing by you? If they did make an effort, then they were looking out for you. If they didn't, they were not. End of story? Well, not quite. If you truly believe that your parents failed you, what then? It seems to me you have a couple of choices. You can resent them for the rest of your life, which is a colossal waste of time and energy. Or you can do nothing. That's right, nada. You can't change anything, so drop it. This is a huge lesson. Everybody has bad stuff happen to him or her in life. Sometimes your parents are the bad stuff. Let it go. Here's a personal story. In the 2002 NBA Finals, some idiot gave Shaquille O'Neal's father courtside seats at the home court of the New Jersey Nets. The powerful L.A. Laker knew his father was there, but would not even look at him. That's because the guy, I won't call him a man, walked away from Shaq when he was a baby and never returned. I say good for O'Neal. By all accounts, his mother is a very special woman, and Shaq is devoted to her. He has obviously succeeded in the NBA, and right now he's a positive influence in this country. He has a right to ignore a father who didn't look out for him. And for good measure, I hope the deadbeat dad knows how much O'Neal is making putting balls through the hoops. How about close to $30 million a year? Most parent-child relationships are not as clear-cut as Shaquille O'Neal's. Many of us have very conflicted emotions about our parents. It's hard to nail down the absolute truth, but you definitely have to sort it out and decide the best course of action. Here's what I did. When I was 17, my father and I had a mini brawl. Lamps were broken, my mother was horrified, but it had to happen. The man had to learn that no longer would his son, me, put up with his unreasonable wrath. And my father surrendered. He knew the physical stuff had to stop. His words were exactly these: "You're on your own." Fine. I went away to college and began to compete. It wasn't easy, but I made my way. I spent summers living at home, but moved out entirely after graduation. But I always kept in touch, and I was always respectful. Eventually, any resentment I had stored up dissipated because I understood that to harbor it would hurt the entire family. So as Hyman Roth told Michael Corleone while discussing the dueling atrocities of their two gangs in The Godfather, I let it go. But I also did a lot of serious thinking about my father's behavior and how it compared with the role of a parent who was really looking out for his child. I think it's worth restating the theme of the commandments. The primary duty of a parent is to give his or her children the tools to build a happy and successful life. Those tools are educational, emotional, and spiritual. If your parent or parents did this, that person was truly looking out for you, and you are one lucky stiff. Chapter 2, It's My Party. It's my party, and I'll cry if I want to. Leslie Gore, It's My Party. So who the heck are you anyway? Are you looking out only for yourself or numero uno? This may surprise you, but if you are a poster child for the me generation, you're in dire trouble. Here's the no-spin truth. America and France lead the world in self-absorption. The USA is the most powerful country the world has ever seen, but our culture has been polluted by the where's mine theme. We see it everywhere, in constant media advertising about possessions and good times and products to make us look as buff and alluring as possible. From the time they are conscious of the outside world, American babies are bombarded with messages of consumption in a way that brainwashes them, sometimes permanently. The buying power of the American consumer drives the country and is as addictive as nicotine. Wall Street depends on it, and the government protects it. The human brain is not fully formed until age 25, but by age 3, the American brain is already screaming, "I want stuff!" Up until about 40 years ago, most Americans didn't have enough money to get hooked on consumption. Credit cards were non-existent. You had to pay as you went. But the 60s changed everything. All of a sudden, it was, do your own thing. If it feels good, do it. You don't have enough dough? Here's a line of credit to make it all happen. Before you could say boo, the baby boomers took off on a gold rush of acquisition and an intense quest for self-satisfaction. At first, the 60s movement was driven by social consciousness. But greedy boomers rushing to embrace the philosophy of abundance soon overran the passive hippies. One problem with the comfort addiction is that it takes a lot of money, energy, and thought to feed the habit. And all of that thought is about you. In the 80s, Hall & Oates wrote a song called Possession Obsession. The refrain says it all. Don't you know it's a matter of fact, the more that you take, the less you give back. But so what, you say, so freaking what? What's wrong with taking care of number one? Well, listen up. If you're always thinking about yourself, you'll rarely look out for anybody else, and you'll soon run out of people who will look out for you. Why is that? Well, let me break this to you gently. Generous people will not associate with selfish jerks. It simply will not happen. To have a friend, you have to be a friend. That's an old Irish saying, and at times the Irish do know what they're talking about. Just don't get them at closing time. Convinced? No? Okay, time then to bust another myth, the one about bad companions. You know, the people your parents told you to stay away from? Well, you don't have to stay away from them, because if you're a decent person, they'll stay away from you. Nobody doing bad things wants you around if you're not in sync with their destructive agenda. Walk into any bar and order a Dr. Pepper. The booze hounds will mock you. You're not welcome at a methamphetamine party if you won't indulge. And you're not wanted at an Enron executive meeting if you're not willing to rob other people blind. The corrupt seek out each other. So if you are hanging around with Tony Soprano, you are already a degenerate. Tony would never let you into Bada Bing in the first place if you weren't. It's important for all Americans to recognize that only good people can really look out for you. Bad people are looking out for themselves and will use you. They will pretend to have your best interest at heart, but will kick you in the head when your usefulness to them expires. But a good friend will last a lifetime, and that person will look out for you if you demonstrate you're worth looking out for. So my premise is simple. Before you can find help in this world, you have to develop qualities that are respected by good people. If you're selfish, shallow, money-grubbing, manipulative, callous, violent, petty, envious, gossipy, or self-destructive, then you will soon be on your own. Nobody will ever look out for you, with the possible exception of your mom, and she is compelled by nature to do so. Now, all of us occasionally do bad things and act selfishly, but self-interest must not define us. I use the term weasel a lot when talking about untrustworthy people. Weasels are by nature small carnivores that hunt alone at night, in the dark, and viciously kill their weaker prey. There are legions of human weasels in America today. They have dens where they hang out with other weasels. But if you're not one of them, they don't want you in the den. And believe me, you don't want to be there. Because if there is just one morsel of weasel food, it will not be shared. The strongest weasel will take it, and the other weasels will starve. There are no socialist weasels. It's amazing to me that many of us just cannot tell the good people from the bad people these days. In my adulthood, I have seen a lot of marriages break up, and I'm always amazed that the aggrieved party didn't see it coming. Selfish, manipulative people usually aren't subtle. Their character is obvious to any perceptive person. The problem is that most Americans do not see people for what they really are. They see them for what they want them to be. Remember the self-delusion factor I mentioned in the introduction. How many times have you seen friends or family attach themselves to just the worst person this side of Saddam Hussein? Everybody knows a person is pond scum except them. And then when the bad person finally turns on your friend, he or she is stunned, betrayed, bewildered. Psychoanalysts make a fortune treating such naive people. But here's some free advice. Well, not exactly, you did buy the book. Watch how your new friend or lover treats other people than you. Watch how she treats her parents. If he's divorced, find out why. If she's dysfunctional, run like hell, even if she does look like Heidi Klum. Adults really change unless desperately motivated to do so. So no matter how good, kind, generous, and loving you are, the heavy odds are that an emotionally damaged person will remain damaged and a bad person will remain bad, no matter what you do. So screw it. You're not supposed to be St. Paul. Conversions of any kind are tough and nearly impossible to achieve if you become emotionally involved. Walk briskly away from destructive people and find generous people with whom to hang out. Then you'll have a chance of finding an effective support system in life. My father trusted almost no one. Thus, he had no one looking out for him except my mother, and her power was, shall we say, limited. It's not that my father was a bad guy. He wasn't. He despised bad guys. He would glare at them and dismissively call them chief. They got the message and didn't mess with him. But my dad also did not cultivate good people because he was a suspicious guy. The few friends he had were working stiffs who retreated from the world just as he did. William O'Reilly Sr. worked in a company for 35 years, and nobody with any pull ever looked out for him. He closed himself off from the two-way street that is loyalty. My grandfather didn't have a support system either, because he was even more suspicious than my father, which put him in the same category as Ebenezer Scrooge. John O'Reilly was a New York City cop who worked the waterfront during Prohibition. He was one tough SOB, but when he left the department, he pretty much retired from life. He stayed out of the fray, rarely offering advice or support, and let my father fend for himself. Unfortunately, my dad didn't know how. He had great talent. He was witty, quick-thinking, honest, and well-spoken, but nobody gave him direction. So, as James Ellroy pointed out, my dad held his mud. If somebody had been looking out for William O'Reilly Sr., his life might have been very different, but my father never sought out good people who might have helped him, and so he didn't find any. You can only go so far solo in this world. My father didn't get very far, and on his deathbed he told me his biggest regret was he had never lived up to his potential. Life is most definitely your party, and as Leslie Gore sang in the semi-innocent early 60s, you can cry if you want to. Lots of folks spend their lives doing just that. But your pursuit of happiness will not be advanced by self-pity. It will not be advanced by fear and poor judgment. What will help you greatly in life is the wisdom and caring of good people. If you are going to devote so much time to shopping, go shopping for them. Oh, and one more thing. Cultivating and nurturing good friends isn't easy. Every 2 years, I put together a trip for a bunch of my male friends from all over the world. Some people are amazed that I can get a couple of dozen guys to show up in a place like Hawaii for a few laughs and a little hell-raising. But these are people who know the value of friendship. I have spent a lifetime assembling these friends, and I know they look out for me just as I look out for them. A few years ago, 18 of us met in the Virgin Islands, and an editor for the magazine Cigar Aficionado, Terry Fagan, tagged along. Here are some of his observations. What brought this group together was friendship with Bill O'Reilly, the executive producer and anchor of The O'Reilly Factor. All of these men have crossed paths with O'Reilly at some point in their lives, some as early as shared childhood in Levittown, Long Island, during the Eisenhower administration. I go back with O'Reilly to first grade, says John Blasey. The vacations are a natural extension of our childhood routine. I would come home from school and call O'Reilly to see what game he had pulled together and where we were to meet. Anyone who watches O'Reilly's talk show can glean a few basic traits about the man. He's smart, quick, opinionated, and doesn't suffer fools gladly. I've known O'Reilly for 29 years. Success hasn't changed him. He's as much a pain in the ass today as he was back then, jokes Mike Dutko, a cop-turned-defense lawyer from Florida. But he's brutally frank and fiercely loyal. He expects nothing less from his friends. He also believes that friendship requires effort and commitment. It's a loyalty that his friends return. So why have I bothered tracking these guys throughout my life? What's in it for me? Well, the answer is nothing much in worldly terms. I've been very lucky and never had to ask anyone for anything substantial. But the men and some women in different circumstances I deal with as friends all have attributes that I admire. They're all honest, so I can get perspective and no-spin opinion on any subject I need. And if I'm ever in dire need, say I lost my job or became very ill, I know these guys would help me in any way they could. Finally, if you follow me on television and radio, you know I often have to walk an editorial tightrope, taking tough positions and sometimes hammering very powerful people. It helps to have people I trust to tell me if I go too far or even not far enough. Not that I always follow the advice, but I do listen. So how many people do you have looking out for you? Or a better question might be, how many non-family members are looking out for you? The second query is the crux of the matter. If you can't tick off five people who would bleed for you, there's a problem. Remember, this looking out for you stuff takes time and energy. It takes smarts and reflection, but it's a key to having the best possible life. And it doesn't matter who you are. If you can't convince quality people to look out for you, you're in trouble. Consider the beautiful singer Mariah Carey, who has money, fame, and power. Here's what she told Vibe magazine after her emotional meltdown. Said Miss Carey, "No one was looking out for the human being that existed inside the machine that pays everybody." Mariah Carey learned the hard way. The rich and powerful have an advantage that everyday people don't have. Here's an example. In September 2002, I was invited to attend the annual Forstmann Little get-together in Aspen, Colorado. Teddy Forstmann is a philanthropist businessman who puts together a weekend full of panels and discussions featuring some of America's most successful citizens. I usually don't attend events like this because I don't feel comfortable among the swells, but Forstmann does some good things with his dough, and he wanted me to talk about heroism, so I said okay and saddled up for the Rockies. The crowd was big name city. Rudy Giuliani, Martha Stewart, Tom Brokaw, Diane Sawyer, Roger Staubach, Prince Andrew, Lance Armstrong, Senator John Glenn, Queen Noor, Alan Greenspan, Karl Rove, Charlie Rose, and on and on. Corporate titans were wandering around all over the place. It was a giant flea market of power, with the focus on networking and information. These kinds of weekends forge alliances and lead to social and business contacts, sometimes even to friendships. They are a part of the privileged game that powerful Americans enjoy. Access to those at the top is limited, but if you have it, many good things can happen for you. Now, I tried to be pleasant. Not an easy thing for your humble correspondent because I'm awful at small talk and trivial pursuits. The truth is that I did manage to tee off Queen Noor, the widow of Jordan's King Hussein. I believe she thought I was a complete barbarian when I told a group that the reason the Arab world would never give the USA a break was that we support Israel and many Arabs hate the Jews. Upon hearing that, the Queen turned a couple of different colors, but it's true, so I have no sympathy for her. After offending the Queen, I went on to say that anyone could perform a heroic act, but that doesn't make one a hero. In order to be a true hero, you have to be a person of honesty and strong character. Someone who puts others ahead of him or herself. I'm not quite sure how the crowd digested that one, but they were well-mannered and no dinner rolls were heaved in my direction. In the 2 days I spent with these affluent people, I learned plenty. I always knew the powerful protected one another, but now I know they enjoy one another's company as well. High up there in the mountains of Colorado was a lesson that every person should be exposed to. Life is a lot easier if you have folks looking out for you, and if they happen to be powerful, that's not a bad thing. Just don't sell your soul for access. But the sad truth is that most of us will never have the aristocracy on our team. I certainly didn't, and now I don't really care about the powerful other than keeping an eye on them. But that doesn't diminish the point. You need other people to help you fulfill your potential. And if you're lucky enough to have Bill Gates thinking that you're swell, the up escalator can kick into gear real fast. Finally, whatever happens at my life party, I have chosen not to cry, at least in public. But I have privately lamented friends lost through acts of God and some of those who have betrayed me. In my younger days, my selection process of people to trust was badly flawed. In short, I rushed things. I confided in people I had known only a brief time and was badly burned on a number of occasions. Because I had grown up in a tight-knit neighborhood where deception was rare, I foolishly thought the business world would contain comrades like my friends back home. Did I hear somebody say the word naive? Actually, I was far beyond naive. I was just plain dumb. And I'll describe some of my major miscalculations later on in this book. I believe you'll be amused. But once somebody betrayed my trust, that somebody rarely got a second chance. I was done with them, unless I received a full explanation and some contrition. One quick example before we get to the American government chapter, which features loads of betrayal. Years ago, I was friends with a fellow broadcaster. Because we were both single and liked the ladies, we had some great times. In most social situations, I make it a policy to let everybody know what the cost of the event or evening will likely be. And I'm always rigidly fair because I have a solid rule. Never scam your friends. Anyway, on a trip to Colorado for a little R&R, I told a guy how much he owed for the hotel room that he and I were splitting. He paused and then asked to see the bill. Okay, fine. I showed him the bill. Then he questioned why he should pay half of the parking charge. Well, since I had paid the entire car rental fee, and he was riding around in that car, I had assumed the car park would be split. But that wasn't the point. I waved the discussion to a close and picked up the parking. It was chump change, not worth the discussion. But that was it for this guy. Number one, he didn't trust me on the bill, even though I had never shortchanged him in the 15 years we had known each other. Indeed, he often benefited financially in our travels because of discounts I got from my job and frequent flyer miles, things like that. And number two, the entire matter was not about money. It was about power. For some reason, unbeknownst to me, the guy was asserting himself. Now, some people might have argued, tried to understand, or even become bitter. Not me. I just walked away. If the guy had later apologized, I might have dealt with him again, but he didn't. And since a person who doesn't trust you cannot possibly look out for you or even be a friend, there was no further common ground on which that man and I could stand. He was history. In the end, you are not what you eat. Rather, you are whom you associate with. If you run around with despicable people, the heavy odds that you are despicable as well. And if you are paying somebody for advice, beware. Many therapists are looking out for your checkbook, not you. So let's dispense with the psychobabble and set up a simple rule to live by. People who give you intoxicants, an unnecessary hard time, dishonest answers, or anything consistently destructive are to be rejected. Any wavering in this regard and you are taking the entrance ramp onto the sad life highway. For when it's all over and you are leaving this life, the difference between my father's death and yours will be the people you let into your life. If you embrace honest, caring, and strong people, I can almost guarantee that you will have accomplished many positive things on this earth. But if you go it alone or book passage on the ship of fools, expect one of those fools to toss you over the side when the big waves come. And if you still don't believe me, then listen to George Washington, the father of the greatest country the world has ever seen. George is my go-to guy on looking out for you quotes. He said, "Associate yourself with men of quality if you esteem your own reputation, for 'tis better to be alone than in bad company." You tell him, GW, bad company will never look out for you. Chapter 3, My Country, 'Tis of Thee, Keep on Rockin' in the Free World, Neil Young. No question about it, the USA is a great place to live if you're willing to get an education, work hard, and persist in the pursuit of happiness. There is, however, one important and somewhat disturbing question. Are the powers that be in America looking out for you? The answer is very clear. No, not really. Surprised? You shouldn't be. America was built on self-reliance and ruthless demands on the individual. Among the founding fathers and subsequent presidents and leaders were few who would attend a pity party. James Garfield, our 20th president, was once asked on the campaign trail about poverty in America. Said Jim, "Poverty is uncomfortable, I can testify. But 9 times out of 10, the best thing that can happen to a young man is to be tossed overboard and compelled to sink or swim for himself." Sink? And our 26th president, Teddy Roosevelt, was even blunter. "Pray not for lighter burdens, but for stronger backs." Strength? Until the mid-1930s, America was a nation that basically said to its citizens, "Your forefathers have given you freedom, so good luck, see you around, hope you make it." Then came the Great Depression, World War II, the Great Society, the Age of Aquarius, the Me Generation, and finally the anything-goes Clinton years. Throughout those generations, everything changed. While John Kennedy once asked what you would do for your country, modern politicians were suddenly lining up to tell you what they were going to give you. And one of the biggest entitlement pushers was JFK's brother, Senator Edward Kennedy. Most giveaway programs have been complete failures, but the rhetorical battle continues to this day. The harsh truth is this. Those running the federal government make a lot of promises, but deliver very little because the system is designed not to aid the individual. In the year 2001, the federal government spent nearly $2 trillion. Who the hell can keep track of that much money? The answer is nobody. As I pointed out in my last book, The No Spin Zone, no government agency even watches how the tax dollars are spent. So money is stolen or wasted and programs turn into chaos with a depressing regularity. It is only when disaster strikes that Congress calls in the General Accounting Office for an investigative audit. Let's be realistic here. The country simply cannot look out for you because A, there are almost 300 million yous in the USA, and B, it basically doesn't want to. Sure, you'll get an inflation-eaten Social Security check when you hit 65, and if you wash out, you might get some unemployment insurance or welfare or other assistance. But this is chump change, designed only to keep you from living beneath a bridge someplace. The truth is that the country wants you to get a good job so you can buy stuff and pay a lot of taxes. But the country is not going to help you get that job. It will, however, help itself to half your paycheck if you do manage to prosper. And once the government takes your money, it will not watch where it's spent. Tax dollars are a major tool that politicians use to buy votes. But once the voting is done, they're not real interested in tracking expenditures. The best example of this is the Big Dig construction scandal in Massachusetts, perhaps the biggest taxpayer ripoff in the history of the USA. The following is hard to believe, but it is the gospel truth. In 1987, President Reagan vetoed the Surface Transportation and Uniform Relocation Assistance Act. Senators Edward Kennedy and Robert Byrd of West Virginia then threatened to pull a number of agricultural subsidies unless senators like North Carolina's Terry Sanford supported the bill and kept it alive in the Senate. Sanford caved, and the bill was passed after Mr. Reagan left office and signed by President Bush the Elder. Kennedy was thrilled when $2.5 billion federal dollars was approved for the Big Dig, which was going to modernize highways and tunnels in the south end of Boston. Later, Kennedy got an additional $100 million more thrown into the pot. Initially budgeted by Massachusetts authorities at $2.6 billion, the dig has now cost, are you ready? Close to $15 billion American taxpayer dollars. And the money's still being spent. For 10 years, Senators Kennedy, John Kerry, and Governors Weld, Cellucci, and Swift all looked the other way as tax money was looted by organized crime, corrupt unions, and incompetent management on the vast construction project. Nobody in power gave a damn or intervened in any effective way because money was pouring into Boston and the geese were getting fat. This kind of stuff happens all the time in America, albeit not on the same massive scale as the Big Dig. If you call Ted Kennedy's office and ask him to comment on the dig, he'll blow you off. His hometown newspaper, the Boston Globe, did a year-long investigation on the dig that documented massive fraud and corruption. Kennedy would not talk to them. So wise up and accept the no-spin reality. Our federal government is not good at helping real people who have real problems. And it doesn't care about the money you give it as long as that revenue train keeps chugging along. But don't despair entirely. Here are some of the things the federal government is good at. Waging war. Collecting taxes from individuals, not corporations. Talking about the future of our kids. Talking about the future of the frozen tundra. Letting Jesse Jackson get away with using his nonprofit organizations for his own enrichment. Sending congresspeople on lavish fact-finding trips to the far corners of the earth. First Lady Hillary Clinton was the poster lady for this. Keeping Camp David looking spiffy. Keeping corruption investigations of powerful elected officials secret. Not really trying to find anything relevant out about those multi-million-dollar investigations. Incarcerating suspected terrorists without charging or trying them. Not that that's a bad thing if you find some guy from Yemen in the mountains of Afghanistan armed with grenades and wearing an I Love Osama t-shirt. And here are some of the things the federal government is not good at. Locating guys named Osama bin Laden, Mullah Omar, and I hope by the publication of this book that the CIA at least has a clue. Stopping illegal aliens from entering the country. Investigating rich and powerful guys who make secret deals like Mark Rich and Bill Clinton. Investigating a guy named Senator Robert Torricelli, who took gifts from a Korean guy named David Chang. Investigating a town in New York that voted 1,400-12 for Hillary Clinton after she visited said town during her 2000 senatorial campaign. A few months after her election, her husband, the president, issued pardons for some of that town's big shots who were serving time for massive fraud. investigating guys named Roger Clinton and Hugh Rodham, who apparently received lots of money for doing nothing but mentioning possible presidential pardons to a variety of bad guys. Running a taxpayer-funded railroad named Amtrak that has lost almost $100 billion. That's right, Dr. Evil, $100 billion. Building highways, bridges, and tunnels that don't involve billions of dollars in cost overruns. Keeping the mafia out of those construction projects. Figuring out that not imposing gas mileage standards hurts every single American except those making and driving SUVs. By the way, our failure to conserve oil put $10 billion a year into Saddam Hussein's bloody pocket. Now, if you analyze these lists closely, you'll find a common thread. You get screwed while powerful, corrupt people skate. Does that sound like the feds are looking out for you? Here's how bad it really is. Corruption, incompetence, and political correctness have spread like the Ebola virus throughout our federal system. And the lack of a disciplined approach to controlling our enemies and securing our borders is one of the main reasons that 3,000 Americans were murdered on September 11, 2001. To understand what has happened, we have to go back to 1996 and take a peek into an Oval Office meeting between the aforementioned President Clinton and Senator Torricelli. Called the Torch because of his volcanic temper, New Jersey's former senator deftly cultivated a neoliberal political persona that mixed pragmatism and pandering. Because New Jersey is home to hundreds of thousands of newly arrived Hispanic immigrants, Torricelli played to the home team and became deeply involved with a variety of issues that struck emotional chords with the new citizens. In 1995, a Guatemalan colonel named Julio Roberto Alpirez was linked to the murder of an American in that chaotic country. For decades, the Guatemalan army had been systematically assassinating leftist rebel leaders and those who they thought supported them. Alpirez apparently controlled some of those death squads, even as he was on the CIA payroll as an informer, a situation not uncommon the world over. Throughout the Cold War, the CIA often paid rightist thugs for information that could be used against communist agitators. The CIA calls these informants assets. Anyway, Torricelli, then a congressman, went public with the story, embarrassed the CIA, and enlisted President Clinton to reform the informer payroll. Sensing political gain, Mr. Clinton ordered the CIA to stop paying any informer suspected of human rights violations or who even had a felony conviction on his record. Any exceptions had to be proved by the CIA brass in Langley, Virginia. President Clinton's order became known as the Torricelli Principle. Within months, U.S. ground intelligence virtually dried up. Scores of CIA station chiefs submitted their retirement papers, knowing they could not as effectively gather intelligence as they had during the Cold War. Without the criminal element informing on the criminal element, the CIA became deaf. Bad people know what other bad people are doing. Mother Teresa does not. These grizzled veterans who retired from the agency were often replaced by young officers with little or no field experience and no context in the shadowy world of counterintelligence. Thus, Osama bin Laden and his murderous zealots developed al-Qaeda with little scrutiny from the CIA. By presidential mandate, the U.S. national security apparatus could not associate with terrorists who might have infiltrated the group or even pay for information about it. Al-Qaeda managed to bomb two U.S. embassies and the USS Cole with few problems because our federal government had minimal intelligence on those missions. Incredibly, even after those attacks, the Torricelli Principle remained in place. It was only after the catastrophe on September 11th that President Bush ordered it out of existence. The FBI endured a similar situation under President Clinton. Because Mr. Clinton and then FBI Chief Louis Freeh despised each other, little information was shared between the Bureau and the executive branch. Early in the Clinton administration, Director Freeh was deeply embarrassed that FBI files found their way into the hands of the Clintons at the White House. Some believe those files were copied and later used for political purposes. Even worse, Freeh knew that Attorney General Janet Reno was blocking all the campaign finance-related investigations involving the president and vice president, and all evidence that Mr. Clinton and Mr. Gore were lying to the American people was being systematically buried by the Justice Department. The bitterness between Free and Clinton is documented in the book Age of Sacred Terror, written by two counterterrorism experts who worked for Mr. Clinton's national security team. They accurately report that Free simply would not tell the White House anything relevant about specific terrorism intelligence the Bureau had developed. The result was that President Clinton and his security advisors were shut out of information about terrorism domestically by Free and internationally by the insane Torricelli principle. And many of us wondered how September 11 could have happened. But astonishingly, innocent Americans dead in the streets were not enough for the federal government to change its ways and actually begin protecting its citizens. Faced with as many as 10 million illegal aliens freely moving about the USA, the Bush administration inexplicably stood by and did very little to stem the tide of illegal immigration. The president would not order the military to the border areas to back up the border patrol, and millions of illegals continue to stream across from Mexico and Canada into the USA. An interesting side note, President Bush did ask Canadian Prime Minister Jean Chrétien to tighten up Canada's immigration policies, which allow entry to pretty much anyone who shows up. Canada also provides generous welfare payments to most immigrants without doing many background checks. The Right Honorable Chrétien, through a translator, diplomatically told the American president to get, well, bent. A few months later, Chrétien's foreign minister called President Bush stupid. But even as Mr. Bush is putting pressure on our friends to the north to control illegal aliens, he was allowing former Payne Weber executive James Ziegler to run the Immigration and Naturalization Service. By most accounts, Commissioner Ziegler was completely clueless. On his watch, INS policies continued to be disorganized and sometimes downright dangerous. The Census Bureau actually gave up counting the illegals because the numbers became so great. Three of the 9/11 hijackers were in the USA illegally. And because James Ziegler and the INS didn't learn from the Al-Qaeda attack, history was to repeat itself in the sensational sniper murder case. In October 2002, the press learned that 17-year-old Lee Boyd Malvo, a.k.a. John Lee Malvo, who together with 41-year-old John Allen Muhammad shot at least 15 Americans, killing 10 of them, had actually been released without supervision from the custody of the INS. Malvo, a Jamaican national, was apprehended by the Border Patrol along with his mother, Una James, near Seattle in January 2002. The Border Patrol classified the pair as stowaways, handing them over to the INS with an immediate deportation recommendation. But the INS overruled the Border Patrol and released Malvo and his mother into the wind. Here's the background to this sorry episode. Malvo and his mother had been smuggled into the USA aboard a ship late in the year 2000. Subsequently, James got a job at a Red Lobster on the Gulf Coast near Naples, Florida. But the teenager migrated northwest to Washington State to join up with John Muhammad, an unemployed drifter who apparently met Malvo and his mother earlier on the island of Antigua, a common transit point for illegals coming by ship to the USA. By December 2001, Una James had also moved to Washington State. There she asked police to find her son, whom she suspected was under the influence of Muhammad. Soon after the cops picked up Malvo, detectives realized both son and mother were illegal aliens. They were turned over to the Border Patrol, where agents did the paperwork and expected to see the pair deported. But Seattle INS official Blake Brown didn't want to deport Malvo and his mother. He ordered the Border Patrol to change the pair's status so they could stay in the USA pending an immigration hearing. The Border Patrol refused, so Brown took unilateral action and changed the designation himself, possibly violating the Immigration Reform Act. Malvo and his mother were released. The rest is history. The teenager has confessed to more than a dozen murders. So what explains the strange actions of the INS? Hold on, you're about to get angry. As soon as I began to investigate the Malvo case on the O'Reilly Factor, I quickly found out why Brown didn't want to issue a deportation order. It was the expense. Yep, you heard that right. Even after 9/11, many INS officials were under pressure from Washington to keep the deportations of illegal aliens to a minimum because they're expensive. In this case, however, the Border Patrol was so furious that Malvo and his mother were set free, it broke Brown's cover and fed the Factor primary source information. We took that information to Attorney General John Ashcroft, who oversees the INS, as well as to the agency itself. We asked Ashcroft what he was going to do about the Malvo situation and the INS chaos in general. Here's a reply we got from Ashcroft's INS spokesperson, Russ Bergeron. Quote, "If Bill O'Reilly doesn't like the way that Malvo was allowed to stay in the country, undetained while he was waiting for his hearing, then he should work to change the law. While everyone says the INS did its job and got Malvo's fingerprints and generally broke the sniper case wide open, O'Reilly remains a voice in the wilderness, shooting his mouth off with only half the facts, and the half he has are wrong. You have a snowball's chance in hell of getting any comment from the Attorney General." Unquote. So there, O'Reilly. Of course, I put the hellish snowball guy's reply on the air, and 1 week later, after tens of thousands of Factor viewers and listeners besieged John Ashcroft's office asking for some answers, Mr. Bergeron returned with another statement. Quote, "The Department of Justice is actively investigating the circumstance surrounding the apprehension of Una James and John Lee Malvo and their entry into the United States. It is critically important that the United States fully and fairly enforce our immigration laws against those who violate them," unquote. Quite a change in tone, don't you think? But the truth is that every powerful person in Washington knows the INS is a mess and that millions of undocumented aliens are putting all of us at risk. They know, but they don't care. Most of them have bodyguards. Think about this. What if the sniper had killed your husband or wife or child? Wouldn't you want John Ashcroft to do something?